Welcome to Vet Talk with Royal Canin, where we address an array of topics relevant to veterinarians and veterinary clinics. I'm Brenda Andreessen, co-CEO at Stevens & Associates, and your host for this conversation on the management of feline and canine chronic enteropathy. Joining me for today's discussion from Royal Canin US is scientific communications nutritionist Dr. Megan Shepherd and Dr. Adam Rudinsky, who is associate professor tenure in the Small Animal Internal Medicine Service at The Ohio State University Veterinary Medical Center. Welcome, Adam, and welcome, Megan.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah, very nice to be here.
We're going to talk a little bit about GI-related cases and how they can put a real strain on veterinary practitioners and pet owners as they work together to manage the disease, customize the treatment plans, and continue to balance the pet's nutritional and lifestyle factors. As veterinary professionals, you obviously work together to deliver a super high level of care to canine and feline patients and focus on both resiliency and persistence while treating chronic enteropathy. And knowing that that can make a world of difference, let's talk a little bit first about the scene for this conversation. What is a working definition, Adam, of chronic enteropathy?
That's a really great start off question, Brenda, because there's actually a lot of confusion around that. So over the last, I would say, roughly 10 years, and Megan, you can weigh in on this as well, we've seen kind of a transition in the field from using kind of catch-all terms like inflammatory bowel disease to now morphing to chronic enteropathy. And those aren't really interchangeable, yet you'll see them utilized like that. So if you look at the core definition of a chronic enteropathy, it's gastrointestinal clinical signs that are lasting either in a chronic sense or recurrent sense for 2 to 3 weeks or more in duration. But the key thing that I like to point out is it doesn't necessarily describe why you have a chronic enteropathy, right? So you could have an infectious chronic enteropathy. You could have a neoplastic chronic enteropathy. Or what we most commonly refer to is our inflammatory chronic enteropathies that are treated with a variety of different modalities.
Megan, anything you want to add in before we dig in a little deeper?
No, just I echo it's complicated. You know, it's a complex, you know, group of chronic GI issues. And to Dr. Odinsky's point, in the name, it doesn't clarify the why. And you have to dig in to get to the why.
Just one thing I would add to that is if for the interested reader that is interested in more kind of expansive discussion of that topic, Julian Dandrew, I think in about 2016 in Journal of Small Animal Practice, put out a really nice kind of conceptual article talking about what is a chronic enteropathy, how do we define that, and what does it mean to us as veterinarians?
So I think that leads in perfectly well. Thank you for that setup to the next part of the question here. With the complications that these types of diseases bring to play, how is this impacting current veterinary practice workloads and the industry at large as pet parents and, of course, their veterinary partners try to help navigate all the different treatment plans, trying to find out what the why is?
Yeah. So from my perspective, it's an interesting problem. This is our kind of area where we really like to kind of work with animals in the clinic, but it's also a really massive problem, right? So if you look at different studies, whether it is in the UK, whether it's in Asia, whether it is in North America, you have overall a prevalence of 10 to 20% of dogs roughly, 10 to 20% of cats roughly are going to have gastrointestinal problems, right? When you look at medical reasons for evaluation in different studies. And when you look at those different prevalence studies, they're not really extrapolating out from acute gastrointestinal diseases versus chronic gastrointestinal diseases. If you turn to the literature on referral centers, you see that the prevalence of chronic enteropathies, how we typically look at them as chronic inflammatory enteropathies, are somewhere between 1% to 2% of all referral cases in a practice setting. So if you are thinking of those numbers the way I look at them, that's actually a really high prevalence, right? So when you translate that to our actual practice and how it affects us as veterinarians on a day-to-day basis. These are core skills and core approaches that we need to kind of have in our toolbox because this problem is so prevalent and because it can affect our patients in such a significant manner, right? There's other literature out there that looks at mortality and end of life cause of death, and gastrointestinal problems list in the top 10 causes on a regular basis, right? So not only are these are financially taxing, they're quality of life taxing, but they're also life taxing, right? They are important on kind of all spectrums for our clients, and it's a big part of what we do in small animal practices, veterinarians.
It's really interesting to hear you talking about, you know, some of the current research, some of the insight that you're gathering and using for your practical application at Ohio State, and really, really underscoring the fact that this is such an important disease to get your hands around because it can have those life-threatening implications. So it's fascinating to hear what you're finding and how you're applying it at the Ohio State. And Megan, how does nutrition support this conversation as well? I mean, bring your expertise to play here a little bit and show us how it connects to what Adam's been talking about.
Yeah. So a couple of things. I know in a bit we'll get into, you know, kind of the dietary approach. And so two things I wanted to highlight, you know, from a nutrition lens are one is the value of a diet history. Taking a good diet history provides a huge context for these patients. It tells us what hasn't worked, and it gives us an idea about where to go from here. And in that diet history taking, there's kind of two main components. There's taking, you know, finding out what is currently fed, and with that, asking in an open-ended way, like, tell me about your pet's diet from the moment you wake to the moment that you go to sleep, and to really, and then you can ask closed-ended questions for clarity, but simply asking what do you feed will render pretty limited information. The second part of diet history taking, especially for our chronic enteropathy patients, is we need to know not just what they're feeding now, but what have they fed. And so having a diet history form, something that the client has time to fill out ahead of the appointment, because at this point, you know, probably you've known, okay, this pet's had some GI issues. Maybe they came in the first time and there was an initial approach and now they're back. Okay, you know, send them home with that diet history form, or send them the diet history form before they come in for that next evaluation, because looking for trends can be really helpful. The second part, aside from diet history taking and getting that really important context to the patient's history, is thinking about how we feed is just as important as what we end up feeding. So whatever we decide that we do, whatever dietary approach we want to make, the implementation of that is just as important as choosing the right diet. Once we've selected whatever that next diet approach is thinking, okay, does the pet owner have all the tools they need to feed it appropriately? Do they know how much to feed? Because, you know, our chronic enteropathy patients may have been losing weight. And so what can we do to help empower the owner to implement the diet for maximal success? And even thinking about, what was the treat situation, or what is the current treat situation? If we don't address that, you know, for the patient that's fed multiple treats, that could end up sabotaging our diet plan as we move forward.
Megan raises two really good points, and two things I would add to it is, it, on her first point about the diet history forms, we actually did a little study here a couple years back. We only put it out into abstract form at the AAVN meeting, but it showed that those dietary history forms actually improve the quality objectively of your nutrition history taking. And what we saw in our hospital population is we went to not meeting AHA guidelines for an appropriate nutritional history to meeting AHA guidelines with something like that. So I think that's a point that I often forget about when I'm in situations discussing this. So I'm so glad Megan brought it up for that that purpose, because it can revolutionize how accurate and the foundation information that you have going into those practices.
So let's talk about that just a little bit further, the idea of nutrition and how it actually can impact the treatment of the disease. Tell me a little bit more about how nutritional plans can work for canine patients, and is there a difference in how they work for feline patients, and how do you determine what the best course of action is from a nutritional perspective? That's a lot of questions right there, all in one, but it kind of all belongs together, it felt like.
It's probably our most underutilized tool when we're thinking of what nutrition can do for gastrointestinal disease. And one of the things I like to live by is, if you're seeing an animal with gastrointestinal disease, it needs a nutritional recommendation, right? One of the reasons we have such high remission rates in the literature for veterinary cases is, in my take on the literature, large part because of the high remission rates achievable with nutrition. If you look at the literature, like, most studies are kind of short-term studies. They look at nutritional response rate over a couple months, and then we have some that kind of extend out longer, maybe 6 months in duration. But regardless of which of those you're looking at, in general, both for dogs and cats, we're seeing at least 50% to 60% of animals in most studies being able to be managed nutritionally. Now, there's some outliers to that, right? There's some studies that report really, really robust nutrition response rates. And there's a few, even one very recently, that reported a surprisingly low response rate. But when you average those out and say, what's the common trend? Half to two-thirds of my cases can be resolved with nutritional management. Well, that's really something I need to emphasize to these clients, because it's something that we need to do anyways, right? We need healthy nutrition for our pets regardless. And if I can fix this problem without medications and utilize food for my therapeutic approach, hey, all the better, right?
I definitely love, like, there's definitely that growing attention as to the number of diet responsive or food responsive chronic enteropathy patients is higher than we've historically appreciated. And I love the attention to, you know, the role diet plays. And I would say, you know, that when nutritional management, you know, I can't emphasize enough, like, the importance of, like, a good foundation, and a good foundation being that it's complete and balanced and meets the patient's essential nutrient needs. These cases can be really challenging. They're challenging. I mean, they can definitely be challenging. And in the midst of that, it's easy to forget about, like, the importance of a solid foundation. Essential nutrients, you know, are not just important for the whole pet. They're important for the GI tract. The GI tract's really metabolically active. And so, you know, just making sure we're meeting essential nutrient needs can go a long way. And then, yeah, as far as dietary approach from there, then there's strategies we can take, you know, to add onto that. To help support the GI tract. And, you know, there's patients, a lot of times chronic enteropathies are classified by what type of diet that they respond to. And, you know, some are going to respond to a very kind of basic core, highly digestible GI diet. Some you need that fiber enhancement. Some you need fat restriction. You need a modified protein, like hydrolyzed protein. And so there's lots of approaches that folks can take. I would tell folks to take a breath and think about, just take that pause and say, okay, what's the next best strategy? You know, you can start basic with, like, hey, let's start with highly digestible. Let's go with that approach. If that doesn't work, then we need to decide where, you know, of the caveats, you know, we need to go from there.
So is that how you would start a food trial? You know, so to speak, there are so many complicating factors. What is a good process to go by when you are trying to do the trial and error process to what actually is going to help that animal?
Yeah, for me, when I look at the dietary trial, right, my kind of, you have to emphasize to clients that, and think about it in the importance that people don't like to change diets right away. Like they're worried about it, they're apprehensive about it, or the restrictions of not feeding other things can become cumbersome for owners. So sitting down and talking to the owner first about what their expectations are, right? The nice thing is with most food intolerances, we're looking at about a 2-week response rate, sometimes a lot quicker than that, right? So for immediately, that's very different than our colleagues that are dealing on the dermatologic side with food allergies, right? Where you're looking at much longer feeding trials, right? So that helps me get owners kind of on board. Hey, just buckle down, see if we can make this work. And then I can usually get pretty good buy-in by them with the time frame, as well as emphasizing that if this works, your animal doesn't need drugs and the side effects that come with it. On my side, what I like to do is exactly what Megan was saying, is I think of nutritional management of gastrointestinal disease in 5 categories. So the digestibility of the diet, the ingredient list, so my limited antigen type limited ingredient diets, my hydrolyzed diets, my fiber enhanced diets, and my fat modified diets. And I like to, with every patient, go through that checklist and say, which of these are important to me? Because there is some data to show that, okay, for most chronic gastrointestinal disease cases, you're going to usually be heading towards a hydrolyzed or a novel ingredient diet, right? And then from there, tweaking it with certain situational differences. So for example, with cats, right, I'm less inclined to use fat-based diets because Dottie LaFlamme's work showed that that really wasn't a major modifier of their outcomes. Whereas with dogs with protein-losing enteropathy, chronic enteropathies, that's something that I'm really going to focus on. So there's species differences. Same thing, the type of clinical signs would affect that for me. If they're more large bowel in terms of the clinical symptomology, the more I'm going to be inclined to use fiber-enhanced diets in those situations. So there's those little caveats, but with each of them, I kind of look at those 5 categories once again and say, which of these is most applicable for this patient? And then also considering that there's lots of diets that have multiple of those factors in one, and you can really get a lot of bang for your buck in those situations.
That's a super logical and practical way to approach where to begin, it would seem. Megan, comments to add to Adam's 5 considerations?
I mean, I love the attention to client expectations, setting the stage up front. And yes, with GI, we do have it is nice that it usually doesn't take long to know if we're heading in the right direction. But yeah, that letting people know up front what to expect. And, you know, not only does it not take so long, but it might take a couple of diet rounds, but you know, it doesn't take long for each of those rounds. So just, you know, be patient with us as we try, you know, the different approaches. If it's a patient that, you know, has first time GI issues, I'll start, you know, with just a highly digestible core GI diet. If they come in with a history that they've done that hasn't helped, then yeah, that differentiation of small versus large bowel can be really helpful. And yeah, similar, like large bowel, high fiber, small bowel, then I'm like, okay, are we going hydrolyzed, low fat? What makes the most sense?
We're fortunate now that we have so many choices too, you know, from a diet perspective. There are a lot of options to try to help solve the problem.
I think that's another good point where there's a lot of importance of knowing your choices, right? Working with the pet food companies, working with your field reps to know what's available to you. I feel like for practitioners, it can be really daunting when you look at all those diets that are out there. But when you actually start practicing with them, you'll see that there's a lot of trends amongst diet types and things that you can kind of hone in pretty quickly. One thing I would reemphasize with Megan's point, because once again, she hits on a great concept, is there is, just because one diet trial fails doesn't mean it's game over. And I think for the right client that's willing to hang in there and try again, it's documented in the literature. I think one of the more recent articles was Dr. Sarah Jablonski's article on it was PLEs in that case, but they had failed a previous diet trial and then responded to a different diet trial after that. So we know that that multiple approach can work and certainly improve your response rate.
Well, the idea of bringing the pet owner into the conversation early on seems to be an incredibly smart one as you try to work together to define the solution. So with that in mind, are there certain breeds or lifestyle factors that pet owners and veterinary professionals seeing them should be aware of in terms of you see a specific kind of dog who is presented and you can automatically think, ah, this could potentially be the problem?
There are certainly some breeds that come to mind, like when I think about GI issues, two different sizes, German Shepherds and Yorkies. While there are breeds that, are highly represented in the chronic GI issue realm, it's important too that veterinary teams recognize that, these patients can come in really of any breed.
Any difference in the feline population? Are there specifics there?
I think when I'm looking at kind of breed and lifestyle factors in general, like Megan said, it's often very useful in terms of like your diagnostic suspicion. The good news is you can still fall back most of the time on those same patterns, right? So, okay, I've got a Yorkie with a protein-losing enteropathy. Fat content in that diet is going to be very important for me. But the same thing, if I've got a St. Bernard with a protein-losing enteropathy, fat content is going to be the same importance for me in that scenario. So there's some things where it helps on the diagnostic side. Certainly we do know there's some differences in terms of breeds and larger breeds potentially having a less inherent digestibility from their own mechanical, enzymatic, et cetera, digestibility in their own gastrointestinal tract. So they may benefit more perhaps from some of those diets. But Megan hit the nail on the head by saying, like, regardless of whether it's one of these prototypic breeds or something that we don't typically think of, it all comes back to those core features. One other thing, though, that I think of a lot, both with pretty much all of my feline cases, and then certainly some of my canine cases that are going to be a little bit more overtly anxious or stress-based in their evaluation in the exam room, is going to be the role of fiber enhancement in the diet and its management of stress-mediated gastrointestinal disease. There's certainly limited data out there. Mike Lieb's paper was the first to show non-inflammatory colitis dogs responding really well to fiber-based diets, or fiber supplementation in the diet is a more accurate way to characterize that. But when I look at those animals, and I think there might be a stress component to their gastrointestinal signs, and it fits very much with like a large bowel clinical symptomology, fiber definitely becomes high on my list, as well as behavioral modification, stress reduction, anxiety reduction, and those types of other modifiers for a holistic approach.
Adam, throughout the conversation, you have referenced a lot of resources that could be really beneficial to our listeners. Is there anything in particular that you want to make sure is included in this conversation as a place for them to go as they explore best practices and solutions?
I think if you're interested in primary literature, there's a lot out there, and you can spend hours and hours and days and weeks reading all of that. But I think what's often a really, really clinically useful approach is to go towards review articles, narrative review type articles. So things like JAVMA used to do a lot of good narrative review articles and still put those out on a regular basis on chronic enteropathy diagnosis, nutritional management, all of those things. Royal Canin's Vet Focus series is wonderful for a lot of these different topics and a very balanced and comprehensive coverage of each of these problems.
Megan, anything you'd like to add to that list?
One, just because it ties back to the emphasis on diet histories, that for those clinics that don't have their own diet history form, if you go to the WASAVA Global Nutrition Guidelines, WASAVA is the World Small Animal Veterinary Association. They have a plethora of resources on that website, and one of them is a diet history form, so folks can use to capture that historical context, that's so important to our chronic enteropathy patients.
This has been an excellent, very insight-filled conversation on what's obviously a complicated topic. So thank you, Dr. Megan Shepherd, and thank you, Dr. Adam Rudinsky, for joining us for this episode of Vet Talk.
Thanks so much.